That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to another episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. I am Dan Newman, your co-host. I'm joined by my brother, Andrew Newman. We are excited to bring you yet another exciting sports history topic here on the Hello, Old Sports podcast. Andrew, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Right as we started this, I just realized that I meant to call our parents before the show started, and I forgot. And by the time we end, it'll be, I think our parents are living in an old folks' home now, and I think they're not allowed to talk on the phone after like 9:30.
That's so not accurate.
Well, after that, it'll be well. It's 10.
Well, no, I mean, none of it's accurate. But continue.
It'll be well after that by then. So for the second straight day, I meant to call them and didn't, but. I suppose by the time this airs, I will have hopefully spoke to them.
Yeah, let's hope. So, and Andrew and I are actually going to see each other this weekend. We are going to a Yankee game that just happens to be Yankee Old Timers Day. So there will be an in-person Hello Old Sports meeting or whatever you want to call it in a couple of days.
Yeah, so reunion for the 2009 Yankees team, the last Yankees championship team. The big story locally has been that Brett Gardner will not be attending.
Is that really a big story?
Not big. There's been a few articles about it today. I guess he's really like, and he's kept his word, but he basically said like when baseball ends, he's like not going to be seen when he's done, when his career is over, and he just like hasn't responded to anything they've said to sent to him in the last few years or whatever. So Brett Gardner will not be there.
Very odd. Well, speaking of championships, we're just about to start the NFL regular season. We're recording this in mid-August, mid to late August. I guess today's the 21st, and it will likely air sometime in early September, just as the NFL season is getting ready to start. And we're going to talk tonight about teams that won two Super Bowls in a row and in every case, the failed attempts to win three Super Bowls in a row. Nobody has ever done it before. I think we made a list, obviously, and I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 teams who have tried and failed, and the ninth team is about to try this coming season, as the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl in 2022 and in 2023. So we thought, as there was going to be a lot of talk probably in the coming weeks about their efforts to win three in a row, we thought it would be a good idea to provide a little bit of a historical context about other teams that have tried to do it and where they fell short.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I had a teacher in school, and he used to always say, 3 years to be champion, it's a long time.
So that's not a teacher that you had in school that said that. That was what Andre the Giant said on Piper's Pit about Hulk Hogan in early 1987.
Yes. But say, I mean, same thing. But yeah, so and this is one where I feel like we should acknowledge right up front. You know, we will as we get into the episode. I get irritated with the NFL when they act like football began in 1966. And it's less understandable with the NFL because like it's their history. You know what I mean? Like I get real furious when you'll see something that says like and put out by the NFL where it says like, you know, of course, the Giants, four-time world champions. And it's like, no, they're eight-time world champions. The Giants have won eight championships. actually sent something because a couple of months ago on the Yankees broadcast, or a couple of weeks ago on a Yankees broadcast, they were talking about Eli Manning was there, and they said like, oh, in between, you know, the Yankees 27 and the Giants 4. And I was like, if you're going to count ones from 1923 for the Yankees, which you should, you have to count ones from the 20s and 30s and 50s for the Giants. But for this, just for the sake of, it's only actually happened two times in the pre-Super Bowl era, or once in the pre-Super Bowl era and the once straddling the two. What was the one the Packers did? Was it like 29 to 31 or something like that?
Packers won in 29, 30, and 31. It was bad, and there was not a league championship game. There actually, it's funny because there wasn't an official league championship game until 33, and in 32, and this is something I want to do an episode on one day, there was sort of an ad hoc championship game in the 1932 season. So sort of right before there was a regular championship game, the Packers won three in a row. No less a Packer expert than Vince Lombardi was not impressed with those three championships in a row. He said, quote, the Little Sisters of the Poor could have won three in a row back then. So even Vince Lombardi did not think 20s and 30s football was something that was worth noting. But I don't know, I might disagree. And there have been a number of teams that have won two in a row in that sort of 45-year period before the Super Bowls. Green Bay themselves did it in the early 60s. Baltimore in the late 50s, Detroit did it, Chicago did it a couple of times. I think the Canton Bulldogs did it way back in the early 1920s, in the very first days of the National Football League. So, you know, maybe that's something we can explore in one way, shape, or form in future episodes. But yeah, we're only going to look at sort of the modern NFL, the NFL with, you know, 20 some odd teams or more, with, you know, an American Football Conference and a National Football Conference, or, you know, an AFL and an NFL, right, you know, for the couple of years. And we're going to talk just about winning three Super Bowls. Like we said, only two teams have ever won three NFL championships in a row. The Packers from 29 to 31, and then the Packers again 40 years later from 65 to 67. And that those three NFL titles encompassed also appearances and victories in the first two Super Bowls. There was no Super Bowl in 65, the first of the three championships. You'd have to assume they would have won it if there had been a third. I think who won the AFL title in 65? I think it was Buffalo. And don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it was Buffalo. So chances are the Packers would have won in 65. But, you know, we're talking just about Super Bowls. So they did not win the Super Bowl in 1968, and we're going to talk about some of the reasons why for that, I think, in just a couple minutes here.
Yeah, and for the record, in 1940 and 41, the Bears won the NFL championship, but by 42, with the war on, they were rationing footballs.
No, that's not accurate. What? They were not rationing right. Footballs.
Yeah, they had to go to the war effort.
No. They missed some players because of the war, but they were not rationing footballs. I mean, there may have been fewer footballs because of leather.
Are you trying to explain this to me as if I'm genuinely misinformed?
No, I hope
instead of just doing the same thing I always do.
Well, I'm trying to explain how that it would even make any sense. Like, even if they were
rationing, that's the point.
Even if they were rationing footballs, they still played the season. They still had a chance to win the third championship.
All right. Anyway, can we get down to business here?
Yes, yes. Can we talk about something more important?
So there's eight teams. I figured I'll read them off real quick just with their record and their result, just in terms of where they lasted in the playoffs. And then I'm guessing we're going to do this chronologically and then rank them at the end. Does that make sense?
Or yes, it does. Yeah. No, let's do that.
All right. So let me just go through these real quick. The 1968 Packers went 6-7-1, did not qualify for the playoffs. The 1974 Dolphins went 11-3 and lost in the divisional playoffs to Oakland. The 1976 Steelers went 10-4 and lost in the AFC Championship game, also to Oakland. The 1980 Steelers went 9-7, did not qualify. The 1990 49ers lost in the went 14-2 and lost in the NFC Championship game to the Giants. The 1994 Cowboys went 12-4 and lost in the NFC Championship game to the 49ers. The 1999 Broncos went 6-10 and did not qualify. And the 2005 Patriots went 10-6 and lost in the divisional playoffs to the Broncos. So real quick, of the eight, three went back to the conference championship game. Two lost in the divisional round. Three did not qualify for the playoffs.
That's right. So why don't we start off with the 1968, the 6-7-1 Packers. The Packers, like we said, had won the NFL title in 65 over Cleveland, no Super Bowl. 66, they beat Dallas in the Cotton Bowl, won in the NFL title game, beat Kansas City in the first Super Bowl. 67, beat the Cowboys again, this time in Green Bay. Ice Bowl, another Super Bowl blowout, Super Bowl II. 1967, they beat the Raiders. So going into 1968, they are preparing to go for this third Super Bowl. And the big loss for them going into 68 is Lombardi. Vince Lombardi, who'd coached the team for 9 years from 59 to 67, nine seasons, was burned out. He was tired. He decided to resign from his coaching job, focus only on his role as general manager. He ends up hating that and going to Washington the following year to coach the Redskins. But the team of the Packers is basically intact. Lombardi is replaced by a guy by the name of Phil Bengston, who had been the defensive coordinator for Lombardi's Packers, I think, for the entire time that Lombardi was there. Go ahead.
He was the only assistant who was there the entire time during the Lombardi tenure from 59 to 67.
He was only there. Lombardi only coached for 9 years.
I said 59 to 67.
You said the Lombardi 10 years.
Tenure. You know, if you're not going to take this seriously, we're not going to do it. I'll talk to somebody else about the 2005 Patriots.
So the Packers, I guess sort of just to frame it a little bit, 67 had been their worst season that they had won a title. They had been sort of a dominant team up until 1966. In 66, they had a 12-2 record. They were, you know, really the best, by far the best team in the NFL. 67, they limped to a 9-4-1 record. And guys are just starting to get old. The Packers win one of the greatest games in NFL history in the Ice Bowl. But, you know, it was a game that they were very, very fortunate to win. They very, very much could have lost. Paul Hornung and Jim Taylor, the Hall of Fame starting backfield for the Packers, both leave after 66. And by 67, the strength is really the defense. It's Hall of Famers, you know, defensive linemen like Willie Davis and Henry Jordan, Ray Nitschke at middle linebacker, Herb Adderley, Willie Wood in the backfield. Bart Starr is a steady, if unspectacular, quarterback. Backfield is sort of a mismatch of a bunch of guys, Elijah Pitts, Donnie Anderson and Jim Grabowski, Chuck Mercine, and, you know, Hall of Famers on the line too, Jerry Kramer, Forrest Gregg. But by 67, they're starting to get old. Lombardi leaves. They really don't lose anybody going from 67 into 68. The only real major losses are retirements by Max McGee and Fuzzy Thurston, who'd been stars of the Packers throughout the 60s. But by 67, both McGee and Thurston were barely playing. Neither were starters anymore. And then they also lose their place kicker, Don Chandler, which we'll talk about that a little bit more in a little bit. The big thing about the Packers by 68, other than the loss of Lombardi, is that they're really just starting to get old. Bart Starr is 34. Jerry Kramer's 32. Forrest Gregg is 35. On the defense, Willie Davis is 34. Henry Jordan, 33. Ray Nitschke, 32. Willie Wood, 32. So they got all of these Hall of Famers, but all these guys are on the north side of 30. And they're just starting to get old. Sports Illustrated actually thinks that the Packers might be the best team ever. They run a cover with Ray Nitschke on the cover of Sports Illustrated right before the season starts, saying basically this could be the best Packer team ever, but not the case.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned that they were getting old. And a lot of their guys are over 30, but really outside of Greg, Bart Starr, Bob Skronsky, who's from around here in Connecticut, there's signs up and things like that about him where I live. Willie Davis, those are the only guys who are over 33 years old. So, I mean, they're most of their starters are over 30, but there was no reason to believe that this was a team that was clearly like, that was it. You know, obviously Lombardi leaving was a big blow to, you know, to the team. But again, at the time you look, you go, well, Lombardi's still there. He's still the one who put the team together. You know, and interestingly enough, you would have thought if I had said to you in 1968, going into the 68 season, the Packers are not going to represent the NFL in the Super Bowl this year. The only team you would have thought of at that point would have been the Dallas Cowboys.
You know, I think Baltimore had been better than you would think they had been. I mean, the Packers had to beat Baltimore in a one-game playoff in 65 for the Western Division Championship. In 67, Baltimore had been a playoff team. That was actually who the Cowboys beat in the first round of the playoffs. So, I don't know, Baltimore, especially with Unitas, even though Unitas doesn't play in 68, but Baltimore had been a pretty good team. So I don't think it was a crazy surprise that Baltimore was there.
Yeah, I didn't realize they were 11-1-2. Because that, you forget that year. That's when they started with the crazy, they were in the Coastal Division. The Colts were in 1967.
Yeah, it was the Century, the Capital, the Coastal, and something else.
Yeah, something else with a C. But you're right. I'm not, that was an incorrect statement there about the Colts. They were 11-1-2 in 1967. But yeah, I mean, this Packer team, it's weird because there's no major winning or losing streaks. They basically, I want to pull up their schedule again. They basically rotate wins and losses, or, you know, there's never more than really like two at a time. They win the first game of the season against the Eagles at Lambeau Field. Then they lose to the Vikings and the Lions. They beat the Falcons. They lose to the Rams. They tie the Detroit Lions, and then they beat the Cowboys at the Cotton Bowl. Mm-hmm. So they're 3-3-1 halfway through the season. And then they lose to the Bears, they lose to the Vikings, beat the Saints, beat the Redskins. They're 5-5-1. And then their last three, they lose to the 49ers, they lose to the Colts on December 7th. And I believe by the time they even go into the game on the 15th against the Bears, they've been eliminated.
They didn't need the Bear. The Bear game didn't mean anything. They lose five games by a touchdown or less. If they had won even two of them, they would have been, if they had won two of those games, they'd have been 8-5-1. The division winners were the Vikings, who were 8-6. So even if two of those games had gone their way, they would have been the division winners. So now 6-7-1 feels like a team that's mediocre at best. And so you think, oh, well, you know, even if they'd won a couple games, they would have only been 8-5-1. Still not a great record, but that was pretty close to what they had been the year before. They were 9-4-1 the year before. And they, you know, they were in sort of a mediocre division, so they could have won it. And then who knows what would have happened. I want to talk a little bit about a couple of games here. Jerry Kramer, first in Jerry Kramer, his Farewell to Football book, which he wrote right after the 68 season. He said that the answer is complicated. And here's what he says. He says, football is a game of inches. And in 1968, the Packers lost a lot of inches. He says, our place kicking was far off its 1967 form. We were hit heavily by injuries, particularly in the defensive line. We missed Lombardi's inspirational genius. We missed Lombardi's tactical offensive brain. And he says we didn't seem to get our share of the breaks in officials' calls. And so he also writes years later in his, says years later in his memoir that was just released a few years ago. He says that he thinks the team maybe had lost their ability to motivate themselves. and that might have been part of it too, is that they were so used to going to turning to Lombardi for motivation that they really couldn't do it. But nonetheless, a couple of these games, week 12 against the 49ers at Kezar Stadium, they're up 20-7 going into the fourth quarter, but their starter and their backup quarterbacks both get injured, so they have to go to a rookie quarterback by the name of Billy Stevens. The 49ers score 20 unanswered points. Billy Stevens doesn't even complete a pass. 49ers lose 27-20. So then the following week, they go in to play the 11-1 Baltimore Colts. They don't have they have to win that game to have any shot at staying in the postseason. They're down 16-3 in the fourth quarter, but they're driving, lose a fumble, and as they're walking off the field, the crowd at Lambeau Field starts to give them a standing ovation. And Jerry Kramer, at first, he doesn't understand why, and then he says he realized that the crowd was cheering them for what they had accomplished over the past decade. So Bengston Lombardi leaves for Washington. Bengston lasts, I think, one more season in 1969 before he is fired by the Packers. Lots of guys start to retire. Jerry Kramer retires after the 68 season. These Hall of Famers graduate. I think Henry Jordan leaves after 69. Bart Starr sticks around, I think, until the early 70s. I think 70 or 71 maybe is Bart Starr's last season. But it's really 68 is sort of the end of the Packer Lombardi dynasty.
Bengston lasted through 70.
Okay, so two more years.
Then spent a year with the Chargers as defensive coordinator, and then actually a year with the Patriots as their head coach in 1972. I have an article here from Sports Illustrated from after the Colts game. The title is Au Revoir Packers, and kind of talks about all the mistakes they made. Said the Baltimore Colts, relying on the toughest defense this side of the Berlin Wall, looked very much like the old Green Bay Packers last week. This was unfortunate for the current edition of the Packers, who looked more like the Vassar Coquettes as the Colts stifled them 16-3. And just kind of talks about how, you know, they're not necessarily dead as a going entity yet, just that the 68 version is dead, and talks about all the mistakes and things like that. Kramer, before the game, when they asked if he thought he had a chance against the Colts, said, "You're damn right we have. We'll beat them." After the game, he shook his head. "I hope we got rid of it all this year. Everything that can happen to a ball club happened. I keep thinking about what it says in the Bible, 3 fat years and then 3 lean, or is it 7-7? We had enough bad luck for 7 years all in one." So, you know, in hindsight, it's clear with this, like, no, it was over. Like when we talk about the Steelers in 80, and we have already, and we will again soon. We have already in a previous episode. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, yeah, it's clear that it's over. But at the time, you know, there'd been years they hadn't won. It's not like they won the championship 9 straight years with Vince Lombardi. You could have seen them having another, you know, another run, but, you know, really it would be outside of a couple of one and done playoff appearances. Mostly, I think in 82 was a strike year, and maybe once in the 70s.
I think they made it in 72.
I think 72 and 82. And I think 82, they might have been like 4-5. They were certainly no great shakes. It really would be 25 years and Brett Favre before the Packers became a competitive franchise again.
I think I want to give a plug here for one of our Sports History Network colleagues. Joe Zagorski has a book called The Year the Packers Came Back, which is about that 1972 Packers team who I believe made the playoffs. Let me just check that real quick. They lost to Washington. They were 10-4, so that's not bad at all. They lost to Washington in the divisional round. So do we want to move on now and talk about the 74 Dolphins? Because this 74 Dolphins, this is a good team.
Yeah, yeah. And more of the teams we talk about are going to be good teams, somewhere on the range of good to great. There's at least, you know, one mediocre, two mediocres, one of which we just talked about, and then one really bad. But everybody else is a degree of good. I mean, you're talking about teams that won the Super Bowl less than a year prior and the year before. So the 74 Dolphins, obviously in 72, they went 14-0. They won the Super Bowl. 73, they went 12-2. They won the Super Bowl again. 74, you know, more of the same. They finish 11-3. They have 12 Pro Bowlers on the team. It's all the names you would expect. Greasy, Bonacani, Mercury Morris, Paul Warfield, Jake Scott, Larry Zonka, Gary Little, Gary Apremi, and to name most of them, but not all of them. So, you know, they go into 74, and it's their, you know, they've won. They, and with them, we should mention, they've been to the Super Bowl 3 years in a row. They won. They got to the Super Bowl in 71 and were hammered by the Cowboys. Then they won in 72 and 73. So they've been the team that's won the AFC almost every year that there's been an AFC at this point, except the very first year.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. You think of the 70s more in the AFC as the province of the Steelers, but early on it is very much the Dolphins.
Yeah. So again, mostly the same mostly the same kind of guys. Greasy is the starts all but one game. Earl Morrill at 40 is still there. He does start one game. I don't know if that was the end of the season or something like that. Certainly the numbers passing don't blow you away in the modern era, but they also didn't need to because they had Larry Zonka, who went 749 yards. Again, in the modern era, doesn't necessarily blow you away, but it was a true committee. They had Benny Malone, a 22-year-old running back, was their second leading rusher. Jim Kick only plays in eight games, only starts eight games. Mercury Morris. So a lot of these guys kind of spread it around. The only guy who breaks more than 500 yards rushing is Larry Zonka, but it's a true sort of offense by committee, I guess. And they get to the 11-3 mark. They lose their first game to New England. Then they win three in a row. They lose in week five to Washington. And then they lose only one more time to the Jets, 17-14 in late November. But they go on a run where they beat pretty much they beat everybody else they play en route to an 11-3 mark.
They lose in the playoffs in, I believe it's the first playoff game they play, right? It's because they lose to Oakland, who then goes on to lose to Pittsburgh in the divisional play, or they lose 28-26 to Oakland in the divisional playoff. And then Oakland goes on to lose to Pittsburgh in the AFC championship game as Pittsburgh goes to its first Super Bowl. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Oakland Raiders of the 70s have a number of games that they either win or lose that end up with names. The Holy Roller is a famous one where it's a fumble where the guys just sort of keep kicking and fumbling the ball before somebody finally falls on it in the end zone. This in the 74 AFC championship or the AFC divisional round is something called the Sea of Hands games, which is Miami up 26-21 with 40 seconds left in the game. Quarterback Kenny Stabler drops back, and while he's falling forward like a bowling pin, he throws a pass to the second string running back Clarence Davis, who had scored only two touchdowns all year and who ironically his nickname is Cement Hands. Davis is covered by three receivers, comes down with the ball, but two Dolphin defensive players also have their hands on the ball. Davis finally pulls it down, and then the Dolphins get the ball back, but Bob Greasy throws almost an immediate interception, and the Dolphins lose the game 28-26 to the Oakland Raiders. There is a little bit of off-the-field turmoil for the Dolphins during this season, despite still putting up decent numbers. Larry Zonka, along with his best friend and backfield mate Jim Kick, as well as Paul Warfield, the Hall of Fame wide receiver for the Dolphins, they all announced during the season that this will be their last year with the Dolphins. Do you know why? We talked about this in a previous episode.
Yeah, and it was kind of confusing to follow, but because I was trying to feel, I was like, well, this must have been after the season. I think it was at the beginning of the 74 season, they announced that they had all signed contracts to play in the World Football League, which would begin play in 1975. So even though they were still very much on the Dolphins in 1974, they were, you know, they'd already announced we're leaving not only the team, but the league at the end of this year. So, you know, the Dolphins still had the piece. It's hard to envision winning a championship after that.
And that's really probably three of your four best offensive weapons in Zonka, Kick, and Warfield. And then the fourth, Mercury Morris, is feuding with Shula all season. There's questions of whether he's hurt. The doctor says he's healthy enough to play, but then Morris still refuses to play. So there's this real sort of ongoing feud between Shula and Mercury Morris. And in fact, I don't believe, let me check here, I don't believe that Morris plays in the playoff game, but I will check on that here and verify. And check out, Andrew and I did an episode, I think probably about 2 years ago, about all of the rival football leagues that popped up. Mercury Morris does not play in this game. Andrew and I did an episode that talked about all the rival football leagues, the various AFLs, the AAFC, years later, the XFL, USFL, all those things. And we talk about the World Football League, which has got a lot of interesting tales to it. Not the least of which is the fact that they were able to sign three of the great offensive players from the defending world champions right off their team in the midst of their going for their third straight championship. So that really kind of kills it. And I don't think that, I know Greasy sticks around for a while, but I don't think the Dolphins are really in 75 there. I guess they do stick around there. They're 10-4 in 75, but they don't make the playoffs. That's crazy. And then 76, what was their record in 76? And then 76, they're down to 6-8, and then back to 10-4 in 77, although it doesn't look like they make the playoffs that year either. So it's a while, seemingly. They make it in 78. They make it at 11-5 in 1978. So there are some playoff appearances, and then, you know, pretty soon they're into the Marino years. Greasy sticks around as the quarterback for several more years, basically through the end of the 70s. They eventually bring Zonka back. I think they bring Zonka back after his tenure with the Giants, if I'm correct on that, because Zonka's with the Giants. He's a key player in the fumble game in the 70s.
Yeah, which would have been in 78. So, yeah, Zonka is with the Dolphins just for 1 year at the end of that in 79.
79, yeah.
Going back to the playoff game, and there's some good – my research on this took me to a few places, not the least of which was – the website for our very own Sports History Network. There's a few, they'll come up a few times here. A lot of articles by the same gentleman, Mark Mortier. He has a whole article and looks like an episode on the 1974 Dolphins. And something that I thought was interesting, the divisional playoff game between the Dolphins and the Raiders. The other side was the Bills. It was the Steelers against, I believe, the Bills.
And that was O.J. Simpson's only ever playoff game.
And obviously the Steelers would go on to win the Super Bowl, but so the Dolphins and had played the Raiders the year before in the AFC Championship game. You know, the Dolphins were the two-time defending Super Bowl champions. So built up was this game that people actually considered it the real Super Bowl. And a lot of the coverage before the game, it was called Super Bowl 8.5. Jeez. So this wasn't just a championship game. This was a divisional playoff game. Like, the winner of this was going to have to win two more games to win a championship. And despite the fact that it is a game with a name all these years later, it was not Super Bowl 8.5. And in fact, it was the birth of an entirely new dynasty in the Steelers.
So we don't have to wait long. The Steelers make it in 75. They make it again in 76. They beat the same Viking team. They beat the same Viking team.
Yeah.
They beat the same Viking team in 74 that the Dolphins had beaten 73. They win again in 75. They beat Dallas in the first of the two great Pittsburgh Dallas Super Bowls of the 1970s. And then in 76, they struggle a little bit, and they do not, like the other two teams we mentioned, they do not make their third straight Super Bowl.
And there's a lot here because, and I'll be honest, nothing. And as a Yankee fan, I am very guilty of this. Nothing is, you know, about 2001, 2003, 97 to a lesser extent, 95. Nothing is worse than listening to people whose teams were in the midst of a dynasty bitch. To be perfectly frank, about years they should have won additional titles within that dynasty. And everything you read about this 76 Steelers team, especially by Steelers fans, Pittsburgh people who were covering the team at the time, whatever, there are a lot of people who insist that this 76 Steelers team was actually the best of any 70s Steelers team. And the reason for that primarily is because they, in a 14-game season, allowed 9.9 points per game. They let up 14 touchdowns in the entire season. They had a run of games after starting. So just to go over this real quick, they started 1-4, and Terry Bradshaw was hurt. They lost to the Raiders 31-28 in week one. They beat the Browns in week two. And then they lost three straight games to New England, Minnesota, and Cleveland. And then they went on a streak, which, if you include the first playoff game, they won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. They won 10 games in a row. And I will just give you the points against, the points that the other team scored. Week 6, Bengals, 6 points. Week 7, Giants, 0 points. Week 8, Chargers, 0 points. Week 9, Chiefs, 0 points. That's three straight shutouts for the record. Dolphins, week 10, 3 points. Oilers, week 11, 16 points. Bengals, week 12, 3 points. Buccaneers, week 13, 0 points. Oilers, week 14, 0 points. And then in the playoff game, did they shut them? I have to go to a different section here. And then they let up a whopping 14 against the Colts on the road in the playoffs. So if you look at the number of, what was that, 5 shutouts in a 10-game span there?
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3. 5 shutouts, 2 games where the other team scored 3 points, and 1 where they scored 6 points. So that's 8 of those 10 games where those teams did not score a touchdown.
This is old now. It's 17 years old, but in 2007, the ESPN named the 10 best defenses of all time, and they included this 1976 team as the greatest team, defensive team of all time. And you talked about the less than 10 points a game. Plenty of Hall of Famers, 8 Steelers, including the entire starting defensive backfield, make it to the Pro Bowl for the Steelers in 1976. Terry Bradshaw gets injured sort of about a third of the way through the season. He's replaced by a backup quarterback by the name of Mike Krusek, who actually goes 6-0 as a starter in replacement of Bradshaw. And this is the best start for a rookie NFL quarterback until 2004, when, interestingly enough, it's another Steeler, Ben Roethlisberger. So a lot of people, Jack Lambert later says that this is the best Steelers team that he ever played on. And they do make it all the way to the AFC Championship game, where they also lose to the Oakland Raiders by a 24-7 score. Both of the starting running backs, Franco Harris and Rocky Blyer, are both injured for this 1976 AFC Championship game. So they lose the game, and they lose it by 17 points. It's not like it's something that they lose in the last minutes, but maybe if not for a couple injuries, they could very well have made the Super Bowl. And who was that Minnesota that the Raiders ended up playing? And the Steelers had already beat Minnesota in a Super Bowl, and Minnesota didn't win any Super Bowls during that time period. So I don't know. They definitely maybe go on the list for the potential closest of all time.
Yeah, some interesting stuff. Another Sports History Network article by Mark again talks about going into the race for the playoffs. Patriots and Colts both stood at 10-3, and Cleveland was 9-4. Winning the division was a sure way for the Steelers to get into the playoffs. It says, before the Monday night matchup between Oakland and Cincinnati, there was a lot of speculation that the Raiders, who had already wrapped up their division, might deliberately lose to the Bengals, thereby giving the Steelers little hope of making the playoffs. But the Bengals did lose. The Bengals lost to the Raiders, beat the Jets. The Steelers closed out by beating the Oilers. They ended the season tied for first place, and they had the tiebreaker over Cincinnati, so they got into the playoffs. The 76 playoffs are very interesting because even though the Steelers are 10-4, that's only good for the 3 seed. Oakland is the 1 seed and Baltimore is the number 2 seed, the 76 Colts, in what has to be one of the last Colts playoff games in Baltimore. I don't know how good they were after that.
What was the year that Burt Jones was MVP? Because I think they must have been a playoff team that year.
Was it 76?
It might have been 76, yeah.
Well, we'll check. So 77, they went back to the... All right, let me just do this real quick. They were in the playoffs in 77. I think that might have been it. Yeah, so they had one more playoff season in their bones. And by 81, they were 2-14. And by 84, they were... In Indianapolis. So one other interesting thing about this, so they go to the playoffs, they play Baltimore. Kind of interesting to think of an early entry into the Steelers Baltimore rivalry.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Is now arguably the best rivalry in the NFL. Do you know what that Steelers Colts playoff game is famous for?
Was that that wasn't the game where like an hour afterward, it's a plane crashed into the stadium. Was it?
It's the plane crash game. Yeah. Like short. I don't even know if it was an hour. The game was over. Most of the stands had cleared out. The stands had cleared out. Like, but it wasn't, there were still like, you know, it was very soon after the game that a plane crashed into the upper deck at Memorial Stadium, and where the season had just ended metaphorically and literally. There was a crash in Baltimore that day, and the Steelers win and move on. But like you said, they suffer injuries to both of their running backs. Both of their, you know, big running backs in this game are injured and go into the... Harrison Blyer, by the way, had both run for 1,000 yards in this 76 season. And then they go, Jack Lambert was the defensive player of the year. They go into the AFC championship game against the Raiders, who they had lost to early in the season, but that may as well have been, you know, years ago at that point. And, you know, we got to call it like it is. The Raiders kicked their butts that day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And Raiders then would go on to win. By the way, the Ken Stabler for Oakland in that game, 10 of 16 for 88 yards in a winning effort for 88 yards. And the leading rusher only ran for 66 yards. So it's not like they had a ton of success there either, but at least not by one guy. But the Raiders win. They go on to beat the Vikings in the Super Bowl, their first championship. And the Steelers' run ends at 2.
But unlike the Packers and the Dolphins, this Steelers team is not done winning. They're not very good in 77. Good enough to make the playoffs, but I read somewhere they actually gave up 100 more points in 77. So that's basically an extra touchdown a game in 1977. But then they're back in 78 and 79. They become sort of more pass oriented in 78 and 79. I think Bradshaw wins the MVP. Terry Bradshaw wins. I don't know which year it is that he wins the NFL MVP, but you know, whereas in the mid 70s, the offense had been more of a running game focus. It's definitely more of a Bradshaw. 78 is when Bradshaw wins the MVP. Bradshaw wins the Super Bowl MVP of both of their Super Bowl wins, 13 over Dallas, 14 over the LA Rams. So they win the two in a row, and then kind of like the Packers in 68, the 80 Steelers get old real quick. And we do a whole episode, another whole episode you can check out. We do a whole episode on sort of the dark years of the Steelers, really beginning with that 80 team. And so we don't, we'll probably get a lot more in depth in that episode that we did a year or so ago than we will in this one. But I think the top line message is that the Steelers really get old starting in 1980.
Yeah. And real quick, before we move fully on from the 76 team, it didn't take effect to the beginning of the 78 season, but this mid 70s Steelers up until this 76 team with this run of, with that, you know, 10 game basically shutout streak finally was enough where the NFL going into the 78 season did change the first of many, or maybe not the first of many, but the first one anybody remembers of many rules to widen, to open up the passing game in the NFL. And that was the creation of the 5 yard bump zone where you couldn't run full bump and run coverage down the field until the ball was in the air starting in 1978. So
yeah, they do have to adjust as the 70s are coming to an end with a lot of their defensive tactics.
Yep. Tactics being used. So you're right. 80. It's in a lot of ways different. And the one sort of symmetry that I think is interesting is that 76 team, as good as they were, started 1-4 and then, you know, didn't lose again until the AFC Championship game. This 1980 team started 4-1. They actually got off to a good start, and then nothing particularly went right after that.
And a bunch of guys, and if you just give me a minute here, I can pull up this list here. A lot of guys retire after the 1980 season, meaning that during the 1980 season, you have a lot of guys who knowing it or not are in their last season. Let me just kind of see if I can think. I think that Blyer retires after the 1980 season. Let me see who's gone starting in 81. I guess it's not as many. Yeah, Blyer's gone. Most of the defense, I guess, is still there. Does Joe Green retire in 80? Is 80 Joe Green's last year? I'm pretty sure that it
is. I think he's on the team in 80, though.
Is he? You know, in 80 he is, but I think he might retire after the 80. Oh, no, he does play in 81. He plays in 14 games in 81. Okay, so I was wrong about that. 80 is not Joe Green's last year. So, but still, it's a team that's getting old. And we talk about in that other episode how one of Chuck Knoll's greatest regrets is that he feels like he's stuck with some of those guys too long. Now, that maybe wasn't quite coming into play in 1980 because you just won two championships with the guys. So, of course, you were going to stick with them. But, yeah, they're just, you know, like you said, they start off decent. I don't know how long they were actually considered in the playoff hunt because, you know, they're never really, they're 7-4 at one point. That's kind of the best record. Well, 4-1 too. So I don't know at what point they were considered eliminated from the playoffs. I don't know if they were still in it going into week 14 or week 16, I should say, against the Chargers when they were 9-6. Going up against the Chargers. I don't know when they were officially eliminated from the playoffs, but they, like the Packers, they got old.
It was late. So they were 8-5 with 3 games to go. They were a game back of Cleveland and tied with Houston. They played a rare Thursday night game. This article here from Once Upon a Time Sports says it would be an offensive embarrassment of breathtaking performance. The Pittsburgh defense held Campbell to 81 yards rushing and did run for 160 yards on its own. They did turn the ball over 5 times. They lost 6-0 on a, this says the ugly result was a 6-0 loss that tainted the TV sets of the national audience. So they go in and they're 9-6 going into the last game of the season. They were playing Monday night against the Chargers. They needed to see what would happen Sunday before they played the Chargers. The issue was, even though they were 9-6, they had gone undefeated against the NFC.
So their conference and division records, yeah,
was poor. They said Pittsburgh was losing tiebreakers against every contender. Cleveland, Houston, Oakland, San Diego, Buffalo, and New England, which is a lot of teams. So by the time they took the field that Monday night, they had already been eliminated. I thought it was interesting that in the AFC in 1980, five different teams went 11-5. The Bills, Browns, Oilers, Chiefs, and Raiders all went 11-5 in 1980. So even New England at 10-6 didn't make the playoffs, as well as Pittsburgh at 9-7. Yeah, compared to, you know, I have an article here from the following August that I think I read at the beginning of the Dark Days episode, where it talks from August 3rd of 81, Steelers insist they're not dead yet. It would turn out that they really were from a dynasty standpoint. So, you know, we're 4 years earlier, you hear about one they really left on the table. Nobody really thinks, you almost have a sense that they sort of maybe got an extra one than they probably could have at the end in 79, that one over the Rams and, you know, just getting there and winning it. And by 80, it was, you know, they had run out of tricks in the league. And the phrase "the league had caught up" is kind of, because really what happened is they got old, but, you know, it was no real sense of romance about this team, just a team that, as good as they were, you know, just the year before, it was just, you know, it was a steady march. The other thing I thought was interesting, for the first time, this happened three times in 1970, and then it happened five times in 1980, as the only times in his career it happened. Terry Bradshaw punted the ball five times in 1980. Jeez. That seems like a lot for like a surprise pooch punt.
Good thing he wasn't still playing in 1990. It was like,
no, I've seen a lot of games from 1990. He's in the CBS pregame booth or pregame show in 1990 that they had downsized that year. It's just him and who the hell? Musburger?
Probably Musburger, yeah.
Anyway, so that's the 80. Sorry.
I was going to say, speaking of 1990, do we want to move ahead to the 90 49ers?
Yeah, I think now the next couple get interesting. Get more interesting. It's already been interesting.
So, you know, Niners, you know, basically the Steelers give way to the Niners as the team of the decade. Niners win it in 81. They win it in 84 with a 15-1 record. The year after they have that 15-1 record, all they do is go out and get one of the greatest players in history in Jerry Rice. So they keep humming. Montana's there. Montana's got some injuries. And so sort of one thing that I think that maybe you don't realize is that the quarterback controversy between Steve Young and Joe Montana starts a lot sooner than people think it does. Starting in like 1988 or maybe even 87, Bill Walsh brought Steve Young in from Tampa with the expectation that Montana's injuries might prevent his career from going on much longer. And so there's a quarterback controversy in San Francisco earlier than you might think. Go ahead.
But so, yeah, they bring him in after actually in 86, after the 86 season, and Montana in 87 that's the year they lose to Minnesota and that kind of big upset. And in 87 and 88, Walsh would even run Young in on certain series or certain plays. But Seifert really didn't embrace that.
The
way Walsh did. Young does start three games in 89, but that's because Montana's hurt.
Yeah.
And in 1990, Young actually barely plays. Young starts one game, which I believe was the last game of the season. I could be wrong about that, but he starts one game. He only appears in six games. He only throws 62 passes. So it was, Seifert seemed less interested in that, because Seifert was a defensive coach. He knew what he had in Montana, whereas Walsh, and we see this with a lot of guys now, they start to believe that their system, you know what I mean? They start to want to tinker and show everybody how smart they are. And that's not to say it's not justified with a guy like Bill Walsh, but by 90, really Montana, when he was healthy, was back to being the every down quarterback.
Yeah, and Montana wins MVP in 1990. He's really having almost a career year here. Let me see. How many MVPs? So he won his only two MVPs. Interestingly enough, for all of the sort of coach quarterback thing with Walsh and Montana, sort of like you said, especially as the 80s went on, Walsh kind of was always trying to do all these new things. Joe Montana really, and also part of the reason Montana starts to thrive in 89 and 90 is because he's manages for the most part to stay healthy and on the field, which, you know, Montana had some years where, you know, 86, he only played in 8 games. 87 was the strike year, although I think Montana crossed the picket line. But anyway, you could expect Montana to miss a couple games. 89, he plays in 13. 89, he starts 15 games, which he hadn't done in 5 years, in 1990, I should say. Hadn't done that since 85. And he wins MVP in 89. He wins MVP in 1990. He has his all-time high for passing yards in 1990. He has, well, it's not his all-time high, but it's up there for his all-time high for touchdown passes. So Montana at 34 years of age in 1990 is really sort of starting to come into his own. 49ers are clearly, I would say, the best team in the 1990 regular season. They start off 10-0. They lose to the Rams in week 11, or in their 11th game. Then they turn around and beat the Giants 7-3 in a classic Monday night game. One of the biggest.
Oh,
Monday
no.
Night.
It's, have you watched that game? Have you ever watched that game?
I've watched it.
It's a brutal game. So that the NFC Championship, the buildup for it is classic. The Giants and 49ers are both 10-0. And it's funny because I very recently have, and I'm not going to try to make this all about the Giants, but I have recently watched every 1990 Giant game. As early as like week 7 on Monday Night Football. And I mean, I guess it makes sense because they have the Giants, you know, they have the game. Yeah. And they're like, well, the Giants just 4 weeks away from that big match with San Francisco. They're both 10-0. They both lose to division rivals the week before. The buildup is huge. The implications are huge. That game is nothing but incomplete passes.
Yeah, I guess I say it was highly rated. It was close. You had Phil Simms and Ronnie Lott going at each other after the game. So that's more what I meant.
The event was a classic. Yes.
Just to talk a little bit about this, this 90 49ers team. Obviously Montana, Hall of Fame quarterback. They got a Hall of Fame, you know, all-time great receiver in Jerry Rice, who has 1,502 yards receiving on exactly 100 catches. Let me see where that, you know, it's one of his highest of his career. He'd have higher. He had 1,848 one year, 1,570 in his second year in the league. God, he was great. You hate to say that Jerry Rice is somebody people forget about, but you just look at him and holy geez, was he an amazing receiver. Charles Haley, 16 sacks on the defense. Hall of Fame defensive back Ronnie Lott is still around. So it's, you know, it's an offensive team, but they're damn good on defense too. They're first in the league in points. They're eighth in the league in points for, but they're second in the league in points against. And I have to imagine the Giants were probably first. So despite Montana's MVP, they're almost just as good, if not better, probably on defense that year as they are on offense. They win their first round playoff game, or their first playoff game, and then they lose the classic 90 NFC title game to the Giants at Candlestick Park, where the Giants don't even make it into the end zone. They beat the 49ers 15-13 on 5 field goals by Matt Barr. And chances are the Giants don't win that game if Lawrence Taylor doesn't force a fumble of Roger Craig late in the game. And right before that, Leonard Marshall knocks Joe Montana out of the game. So you'd have to imagine, sort of knowing what we know now, that they would have beaten Buffalo in that Super Bowl. So I don't know.
Let's save that because there's when we rank these, there's a lot to talk about. And obviously this team is going to be at or near the top, but there's a few aspects of that I want to touch on. But yeah, that would have been a classic game. And, you know, there are games where your team wins, and if somebody says, well, we were the better team, you sort of balk at that, right? You go, mm-hmm. No, well, we did, you know. And people go, well, I think we were the better team that year. I'm like, no, the Giants are the better team, or the, you know, the Yankees are the better team, or the Knicks are the better team. Like, it's a silly example, but the Knicks-Sixers first-round playoff series this year. If somebody said to me, well, the Sixers were the better team, I'd be like, no, they weren't. The Knicks were the better team. This game for this generation and Super Bowl 42 for the Giants and against the Patriots, what makes it such a great win is they weren't the better team. Like, yeah. If somebody mm-hmm. said, well, the 49ers are the better team, I'd be like, yeah, that's why it was such a great win, that the Giants were able to beat them with 5 field goals on the road in the NFC Championship game. At one point in this season, by the way, the 49ers had won 18 consecutive games because they had won their last 5 regular season games and 3 playoff games in 89, and then their first 10 regular season games in 1990.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy. So do we want to we're going to be talking about the 49ers again in a different context here, but do we want to move on? 1994 Dallas Cowboys, who had beaten Buffalo in 2 straight Super Bowls, led by a trio of Hall of Famers on offense, Aikman, Irvin, and Emmitt Smith, and a future Hall of Fame coach in Jimmy Johnson, a couple of future Hall of Famers on the defense, including the aforementioned Charles Haley. But 94 is a different year for them.
So, yeah, so let's just real quick on what happened since 90. 91's kind of a weird year. Cowboys in 90 almost make the playoffs. They miss it on the last game of the season. 91, they get to the playoffs. They lose in the second round. It's kind of a Washington over Detroit is the NFC Championship game. It's just by 92, it's the Cowboys and the 49ers again. Cowboys have that victory, or the Cowboys have that victory at Candlestick Park in 92. But Young is the MVP of the league, but Cowboys win the Super Bowl. 93, the Cowboys are even better. They beat the 49ers again in the NFC Championship. Going into 94, though, is also the first year of modern free agency. So a lot happens in that regard. The 49ers bring in Deion Sanders, for example. But obviously the biggest story for the Cowboys is Jimmy Johnson and Jerry Jones, who, God, when did their feud start? Because Johnson was not there very long. And Johnson was not there very long, but also their feud lasted for a long time before Johnson left. Was it by, like, I'm guessing by 92, the two of them had really started not liking each other very much.
You know, I read up on this a little bit. They were two big egos. Because they had been, what, friends in college? They had known each other in college. They might have even played football together in college, if I'm remembering correctly. But I think it was always sort of a clash. There's a great book by Jeff Perlman called Boys Will Be Boys, which is about this dynasty. I think there's something sort of like in the immediate aftermath of the Super Bowl. Jerry Jones later said, I knew as early as 1991 that he maybe was thinking about moving on from Jimmy Johnson. That's before they've even really, you know, started making the playoffs, let alone winning Super Bowls. They just sort of both had egos and they clash. Johnson says that it reaches a critical mass the day before the 1992 NFL draft, which again is before they've won any championships. The Cowboys, Jimmy Johnson makes a trade actually with Bill Belichick, who's in Cleveland, trading 5 draft picks in exchange for 2 Cleveland draft picks. And Jones doesn't know about this, so he's irate. He later says to Johnson, there's going to be a camera in the draft room, so please make it seem like you're consulting with me before we make a pick, so it looks like I'm doing something. You know, there's talk about sort of Jones becoming increasingly cheap with the players. Let me just see what else. I don't see it right in front of me, but I think there was, you know, there were some confrontations after there'd been some drinking, I think, at various sort of NFL functions. There's an article here, March 24th of 94, that says Jimmy Johnson is reconsidering his future as coach of the Cowboys. Yeah, it's just like things relate. You know, just I think there's a drunken confrontations here. At one point, Jones says something, I believe, to a reporter that says that there are 500 people who could have coached the team to the Super Bowl. He said, I could have coached this team to the Super Bowl, takes credit for bringing in all the players. I think also Jimmy Johnson, who I think if Jimmy Johnson had gotten to live his life any way he wanted to, he probably would have never left the state of Florida for more than a day at a time. And so he's flirting with the soon to be incoming Jacksonville Jaguars franchise. So that's a part of it. So yeah, there's just a lot. And I'm sure if I took some time, I could maybe parse it out a little bit, but two big personalities are unable to coexist after 5 years together. And so Jones fires Johnson, or they mutually agree to part ways. And instead, they bring in a much more affable and much less disciplined guy in Barry Switzer.
They bring in Barry Switzer, who'd been the coach at Oklahoma for years as a college coach. He comes in and, you know, really takes over as good a situation as you're ever going to take over. It's rare a job like this comes open. And the 94 Cowboys, it won't be long before Switzer really doesn't get along with a lot of the players. Didn't him and Aikman like not even talk to each other or something like that?
Well, and the ironic thing is that he had actually played for Switzer at Oklahoma, but Aikman left Oklahoma to go play at UCLA. So they had interacted previously. Yeah, there's famous clips of this is from a couple of years later after they had won the 95 Super Bowl. There's famous clips of Aikman sort of basically getting really angry at the fact that Switzer is not more of a disciplinarian, saying basically, you know, the practices aren't difficult, you're not running enough, you know, this and that. And Switzer's response is, the only one I've ever heard say that the practices aren't rough enough is a quarterback, because the quarterbacks don't have to participate in, you know, 98% of the physicality of it. So yeah, differing philosophies. Switzer is not a guy who, he's not a disciplined guy. He's really in any facet of his coaching, whether it's on the field or off the field. And I feel like it's right around now where a lot of this off the field stuff, whether it's Michael Irvin with the cocaine or all that stuff, I can't swear that it was all this 94 year, but it all happens under the Barry Switzer regime.
Yeah, but it would be inaccurate to paint this as any sort of team in disarray. There's still one of the best, you know, one of the two best teams in football without question. They're, you know, if you look at the numbers, Aikman's numbers aren't crazy impressive. He throws for 2,600 yards, which is good, but 13 touchdowns, 12 interceptions. But it's 25-year-old Emmitt Smith runs for just under 1,500 yards. You have, how old is Irvin here? You have 28-year-old Michael Irvin with 1,241 receiving yards. Alvin Harper adds another 821 yards. They have the second-ranked offense and third-ranked defense in the NFL. They are 12-4. They start out 2-0. They lose a game 3 to the Lions in overtime. So they're 2-1. They go into their bye. They reel off 5 victories in a row, or 6 victories in a row after that, to get to 8-1 going into the big showdown in week 11 against the 49ers. The 49ers, who, you know, clearly their biggest competition in the NFL, have been for the last 2 years. 49ers have been very aggressive in the first year of, you know, open free agency, unrestricted free agency. It would come out years later that that's because they were not really abiding by any of the rules. If the 94 49ers were a college team, they would have been forced to vacate a bunch of their wins.
Maybe, let's talk about that for a minute, because you're right about that. And this was going to be sort of my conclusion on this. You're right. They make it all the way to the NFC Championship game. And you know, you'll go through that in a second. The Cowboys, that is. And then they lose to San Francisco, and then San Francisco just annihilates a Chargers team. This is probably the one that's less about what that team does and more about what other teams go out and do. And one of the big things is that the 49ers, sort of the knock on the 49ers, and you know, you and I remember this because we were NFL fans by this time. The knock on the 49ers is that they're just an offensive team and their defense is no good. Now, throughout the 80s, they had Ronnie Lott and Charles Haley, among others. So it's hard to say that they were not at all about defense. But one of the things that the 49ers do is in the offseason of 94, they go out and sign a bunch of guys. They sign a strong safety by the name of Tim McDonald, who had been a multi-time Pro Bowl safety with the Phoenix Cardinals. They bring in Ricky Jackson, who had been who's a Hall of Famer and had been a great linebacker with the New Orleans Saints. They bring in Richard Dent, who actually doesn't end up factoring in all that much because I think he gets injured and only plays like four games, but still a Hall of Fame defensive end, a guy who had been on the 85 Bears. Couple games into the season, they signed Deion Sanders, one of the greatest, if not, you know, one of the greatest defensive backs and, you know, one of the 50 to 75 greatest players in NFL history. And then they also bring in the linebacker, Ken Norton Jr., who had been a Pro Bowler the year before and one of the leaders of the defense of the world champion Dallas Cowboys. And I remember this narrative at the time. They brought in, you know, what, three future Hall of Famers, Dent, Jackson, and Deion Sanders, plus Tim McDonald, who'd been to the Pro Bowl a bunch of times. Likewise with Ken Norton Jr., and they also steal him away from their biggest rivals. So, you know, the 49ers in the 94 offseason bring in five or six good, very, very good to great defensive players. So in a lot of ways, that more than anything is what it's about for the Cowboys in 94.
And as early as September of 94, I have a Los Angeles Times article by Dennis Gorgato, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. There were other teams complaining about what the 49ers were doing with their salary cap then. It's not something that nobody thought about at the time. And I guess the 49ers, what they did was kind of defer a bunch of money like years in the future and do these all these incentive-laden contracts. And this article has a thing from Jerry Jones where he says they're not cheating. He just thinks they're being short-sighted by doing that. So, the regular season game, obviously a very anticipated matchup. The 49ers go into the game 7-2. The Cowboys go in 8-1. It's in San Francisco. The Cowboys get a touchdown early in the game to go up 7-0. But the rest of the game is pretty much all 49ers. Young rushes for a touchdown, hits Rice for a touchdown, hits Brent Jones for a touchdown. It's 21-7. I believe the 49ers or the Cowboys score. The final is 21-14, but that's because the Cowboys score with a minute and 30 to go to make it 21-14 and then don't get the onside kick and the 49ers run the clock out. In this game, Aikman also throws three interceptions in the game. He is 23 of 42 for 339 yards and three touchdowns, but no touchdowns though. And he also throws three interceptions. Whereas Young is 12 of 21 for 183, so not nearly as impressive, but two touchdowns and no interceptions. So the 49ers get the inside edge there on if there's going to be an NFC Championship game between the 49ers and the Cowboys, which was seen as a foregone conclusion at that point in 94. It was most of the San Francisco 49ers had the inside track on it. Cowboys continued to win. They got up to 11-2. They did lose to those Bill Belichick Cleveland Browns 19-14 in week 15 that basically doomed them. And then in week 17 on Christmas Eve, they lost again to the Giants, but they were resting their starters. So they 12-3 finished to the regular season if you don't really put too much stock in the last game of the season. It is good enough for the two seed. this was the year I'll always remember where the 49ers were the one seed, the Cowboys were the two seed, and then the 3 through 6 seeds were all NFC Central teams.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it was when everybody but Tampa,
except for Tampa, yeah. So I think Green Bay beat Detroit, and Chicago beat Minnesota in the wild card round. In the divisional round, San Francisco beat up on Chicago, and Green Bay or Dallas beat up on Green Bay 28-9. Never really a game, or excuse me, it was 28-9 at halftime. It was 35-9 was the final score. So yeah, it was 28-9 at halftime. It was a 35-9 game, really no contest. And that set the stage for the NFC Championship game for the third consecutive year. The 49ers and the Cowboys, it's back in San Francisco. And I vaguely remember at the time people still thinking this was the 49ers year, even though the Cowboys were two-time defending champions, even though, you know, ostensibly they were very even. I think the 49ers, not just because they were at home, because 2 years before the Cowboys had beaten them at home, I remember there being some real confidence that the 49ers were likely going to win this game.
Yeah, I think because the defense had gotten so much better, because Steve Young was having another MVP year, because even though they hadn't had it the year before, you know, they did have the home field advantage, you know, even though they'd lost with it in 92, though, like you said, I think there was starting to be some disarray. I think that Switzer was sort of showing himself to be not the coach that Jimmy Johnson was. Now, the fact is they do win it the following year, so Switzer is a world champion coach, but I think that for a lot of reasons, you were starting to notice that the team was not the powerhouse, even though they're the second best team in the NFL. They're not the juggernaut they'd been the previous 2 years.
So if you look at the box score of this game, a couple of things kind of stand out. 49ers win 38-28. You know, so you go, all right, it was not super close, but, you know, not a blowout either. And then the other thing you look at, you try to find out who had a big game for the 49ers. Young was 13-29 for 155 yards and 2 touchdowns. All right. I mean, 2 touchdowns, but still nothing tremendous. Ricky Waters had 72 rushing yards. You look and you just kind of like, where is the big game from somebody? And the reason you don't really see that is because this game, you know, played between two championship caliber teams. I don't think that's any kind of an understatement. This is the way this game went. So the 49ers or the Cowboys start off with the ball, and on like the third play from scrimmage, Aikman throws a pick six taken back by Eric Davis for a 44 yard touchdown at 7-0. Cowboys get the ball back. On a 3rd and 17, Aikman throws it to Irvin. Irvin trying to get a stretch for a first down, fumbles. It's recovered by Tim McDonald of the 49ers. A couple of plays later, Young hits Ricky Waters for a touchdown. It's 14-0. Then the 49ers kick off. It's fumbled by Kevin Williams and recovered by Doug Bryan, the 49ers kicker.
Jeez.
Again, a few plays later, the 49ers go up 21-0. San Francisco, Dallas does answer with a touchdown to make it 21-7, but the Cowboys just dug themselves a hole. In the end, Aikman, who threw 3 interceptions in their regular season game, throws 3 interceptions in this game. Even though San Francisco doesn't even get the 300 yards of offense, they are up big in this game. It's again one where the Cowboys score maybe like midway through the fourth quarter to make it 38-28, but never really threatening the game. The 49ers go on to destroy the Chargers in a Super Bowl that was less competitive there was a blowout even quicker than this one was, with even less chance of a comeback. And the Cowboys bid to three-peat is stopped, although, like you mentioned, they would be back the next year and win a championship, which to date is their last one.
Just a couple quick things. The one point where maybe the Cowboys had a chance to get back in it, 24-14 late in the first half, and they have the ball you know, they're deep in their own territory, but they got a minute remaining, so they could maybe even try and get at least a field goal. Barry Switzer calls three straight passing plays. They all fall incomplete. The Cowboys punter, John Jett, shanks a 23-yarder, 8 seconds left on the clock, and Young throws a 28-yard passing touchdown to Rice. Ironically, the cornerback who Rice beats on this is Larry Brown, who a year later would be one of the most unlikely MVPs in Super Bowl history. But instead of going down 24-14 or maybe even, you know, 24-17 at halftime, they're down 31-14. And so it's a 3-score game. So you're right. They never recover. The only other interesting thing I would say, and this is more about the 49ers and the Cowboys, is that at this point, everybody was sort of just assuming that every damn year it was going to be the Cowboys and the 49ers. But this is actually the last year. The following year, Green Bay beats the 49ers in the conference semi, you know, in the divisional round, and it's Packers Cowboys. So, you know, this was the last of the 3 years of the 49ers and Cowboys NFC title games.
Yeah, and I don't think the Cowboys have gotten that far again. I think after 95, I don't think they've been back to, I know they haven't been to a Super Bowl.
No,
I don't think they've been to a conference championship game since 1995.
No, because the year the Giants beat him, that was a division round. And I don't know if they ever even won a playoff game in the Parcells years. And then recently
they didn't win a playoff game again until 99 or till 09.
Okay. And then, you know, recent years they've been a little better, but they haven't made a conference championship game.
Nope.
Should we move on to something a little different, or did you have a closing point on this one?
No, we'll obviously revisit it a little bit at the end. But so we fast forward a couple of years. The 1999 Denver Broncos who had, you know, in the 80s were famous. They got the 3 Super Bowls. They got destroyed in each one. They, in the 90s, became a team that, you know, was a perennial playoff team, but, you know, they lost to the Bills 1 year in the conference championship. They lost to the Jaguars in, I think, 96 in the second round, and what was seen as a big sort of embarrassing loss for John Elway. And then in 97, they kind of rode this wave into the Super Bowl, and the Denver Broncos, who were, you know, perhaps second to Buffalo as the most synonymous team for the AFC's futility in that 15-year period, are the first AFC team to win a Super Bowl
in over a decade. Yeah.
Yeah, since 83, they beat a heavily favored Packers team. They get back the next year for good measure and beat the Falcons in the Super Bowl immediately.
Just to bring up another past episode of ours, in a game that I think made it into one of our worst Super Bowls of all time, that Broncos Falcons Super Bowl, when we did that list earlier this year.
Just not much juice to it. Pretty much, I think it was known beforehand, but it was official pretty quickly after this. John Elway retires. Mm-hmm. So you go into 1999 with the Broncos, and while, yeah, you're losing John Elway in his prime, you still have a prime Terrell Davis, all the other guys who were part of that back-to-back championship team. In the AFC, I guess the Jets would have been seen as their biggest threat. That was the year the Jets were supposed to be really, really good.
Yeah, and I want to touch on something there in a second.
But they go in, I think all offseason it was kind of assumed that Bubby Brister would be the starting quarterback. They end up deciding on Brian Greasy, the young quarterback, son of Bob Greasy, who we talked about earlier. He's 24 years old, whereas Bubby Brister's 37. And I don't think anybody actually expected them to repeat as Super Bowl champions for the third time. But it was a question of, you know, how far and how fast would they fall?
And this is the 98 had been the best NFL season for future Hall of Famer Terrell Davis, who ran for 2008 yards and 21 TDs. And the 2008 yards, there's only been a handful of guys who've had 2000 yard seasons. I think eight guys have had 2,000 yard seasons. I believe the first was O.J. Simpson. Eric Dickerson did it in 84. Barry Sanders, Terrell Davis, and then in 98. And then since then, Jamal Lewis, Chris Johnson in 2009 and Derrick Henry in 2020, with an Adrian Peterson for the Vikings sandwiched in between there. Terrell Davis had been MVP of the league in 1998, and he was really their juggernaut offensive star. He was MVP of the first Super Bowl, the 97 Super Bowl when they beat Green Bay. So everybody was expecting him to really carry them, but he only plays for four games before suffering a season-ending injury. And this is kind of the beginning of the end for him? I guess probably not. He's probably got a little more. No, this is the beginning of the end for him. He plays in four games in 99, four games in 2000, and eight games in 2001 before retiring. So basically he plays the equivalent of one season over the course of 3 years. A very interesting Hall of Fame career for Terrell Davis in that he's got four dominant years and then three okay to bad years ravaged by injuries, and then he retires before he hits 30. This is also interesting because this is during the time period, I don't know if you remember this, where the Broncos just plugged in a different 1,000-yard rusher every year.
Yeah, for a little while after this, yeah.
99, he's replaced by a rookie by the name of Olandis Gary, who runs for 1,159 yards. And I believe Gary eventually just becomes a fullback. Like, I think he was the one who basically, yeah, because he still plays for a few more years. But like in 2002, a guy who rushed for 1,150 yards in his rookie season plays in 13 games and only runs the ball 37 times. So that's less than three times a game. And then in 2000, I believe it was it Mike Anderson? Yeah, Mike Anderson has another monster rookie year, 297 rushes for 1,487 yards. So yeah, they do plug in another 1,000-yard rusher, but the guy's not Terrell Davis. And then in 2002, another guy, this is crazy. 3 years out of four, they have a rookie run for over 1,000 yards because they have Clinton Portis in 2002. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, and I do remember that for years they would just, it would be a different running back, and then Portis was the one that ultimately they made that trade with Washington, and they got Champ Bailey
yeah.
Portis actually had some really, really good years with Washington on teams that were usually not very good. So also on this team, they had Shannon Sharp. Forget he was still there, because the next year he would be a big part of the Ravens Super Bowl team. Mm. He gets hurt in week five. So Davis is Elway's gone. Davis is hurt in week four. Shannon Sharp is hurt in week five. Interestingly enough, Rod Smith and Ed McCaffrey both have 1,000-yard rushing seasons. But absent Sharp, Elway, those guys were really good receivers, but they weren't going to be the ones, you know, if you take away the other three weapons, just two receivers having 1,000-yard seasons is not enough. Especially, I don't know who their third leading receiver was, but I'll look it up. It's probably not a guy who had very many.
Here's an interesting way to look at this. 98 Broncos. So the 97 Broncos have five future Hall of Famers. They have Elway, Davis, Sharp, and then they have an offensive tackle by the name of Gary Zimmerman, who I believe retires after the 97 season. And then they have safety Steve Atwater, who has been on the team like Elway. He's been on the team since the 1980s and had played in some of those Super Bowls with them. Yeah, Zimmerman retires after 97. But in 98, they got four future Hall of Famers. They got Elway, they got Atwater, they got Davis, and they got Sharp. After the 98 season, Elway retires. Atwater actually goes to the Jets because he thinks he's going to be one of the last pieces for this Jets team that everybody thinks under Parcells that's going to a Super Bowl in 99. Davis gets hurt in week four. Shannon Sharp plays five games, and then he's out for the season with a broken collarbone. So basically none of the Hall of Famers that they'd had on the team the previous year are there by the middle of October. And this team is never really in it. They start off 0-4. They're not,
which is tied. It's the worst record to start the season for a defending Super Bowl champion until the 2022 Rams.
Okay. So yeah, they're bad. They never really, do they ever, I guess they make it to 2-4, but then they lose the next two. So at that point they're 2-6, and yeah, they're never any better than, a bad team here. So yeah, never really.
They're never less than three games under 500 after 2-4. I looked it up, by the way. So after McCaffrey and Smith, the third leading receiver was Byron Chamberlain, who was a backup tight end, who was their third tight end because he didn't even start at any point. He had 488 receiving yards. Their third leading receiver was Shannon Sharp, who only played in five games.
That's always the sign of something bad, whether it's, power numbers in baseball, like RBIs or home runs or whatever. When a guy who misses a good chunk of the season is still up there in those stats, yeah, that's a pretty good sign that it's not that it's a bad team. So yeah, so the Broncos, they're not done under Shanahan. They make a couple more playoffs. They're actually decent in 2000. They're 11-5. But 99 is a bad year, and I think, like you said, probably hadn't been expected to do much in the first place with Elway having retired. And once Davis and Sharp go down, you can almost a guarantee that they're not going to do anything.
So the last team we'll talk about, and this is the last season that this has been a factor until we kick off this season, just about 2 weeks from now, 2 weeks and a day from now, the 2005 Patriots. The Patriots story is obviously one that's well known. This is really about the first half of the dynasty, because the second half, they made three straight Super Bowls, but they lost the one in the middle. Yeah. So they won one, missed a year. They won one, they lost one, they won one. So they never even went for a third straight Super Bowl in that time frame. The 0-1 Patriots, obviously that real upstart team that beat the Rams. 0-2, they kind of fall out. They look like maybe they were a one-year wonder. Then 0-3 and 0-4, they have these really, really good dominant seasons, the sort of first leg of the double dynasty, I call it. And they win those two. The Panthers Super Bowl was thrilling. The Eagles Super Bowl was a close game. They go into 0-5, and it's interesting because for years, and I'm talking really right up until the end of the Patriot run, when I would ask people a trivia question of name the starting quarterbacks the Tom Brady Patriots lost to in the Super Bowl, lost to in the playoffs, this would always be the one they forget. Because
yeah, you've given me this before. Is it David Gerrard for it's Denver. So it's is that Jake Plummer for them in 05?
Yeah. So it's funny because going into this season, everybody kind of acknowledged that the Patriots were probably not the favorites. And the reason was everybody decided, and they were right up until the playoffs, that this was going to be the year for the Colts, that this was going to be the year the Colts were finally going to get over the hump. They had, struggled. They lost to the Patriots in the playoffs, and that this would be the year the Peyton Manning Colts would finally take that leap and they would be off by a year. But just to talk about the beginning with the 05 Patriots and some sort of moving on, and people kind of not forget, but it's almost overlooked it. There was a 10-year gap where the Patriots didn't win a Super Bowl. They got to the two, they lost to the Giants. Mm-hmm. But the early, at the end of the, between the 04 and the start of the 05 season, they lose both their coordinators. Charlie Weiss goes to coach Notre Dame. Romeo Crennel goes to coach the Browns. Eric Mangini is actually promoted to the defensive coordinator in Romeo Crennel's absence. Teddy Bruschi has a stroke week after the parade. He has a stroke, and while he does come back about halfway through the season, at the time it was kind of assumed his NFL career was over. They released Ty Law, and Marvin Harrison is injured. So really staples of this team, and specifically guys who were sort of the heart and soul of that defense of those first three championship teams, are all either gone or not available for the beginning of the 05 season.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still a team with Tom Brady. It is still a team that, you know, is in that. I have to go back and place myself from a divisional standpoint, but they were certainly going to be considered the favorites to win that division that time. They rotate wins and losses for their first 9 games of the season. So they go win, loss, win, loss, win, loss, win, loss, and then win. So they're 4-4, having rotated nothing but wins and losses, including getting destroyed by the Colts 40-21 in New England on a Monday night.
And I think this was the first time that either Manning had beaten Brady or the Colts had beaten Belichick in the Belichick years. Like, it was a milestone for Manning and the Colts to beat the Patriots that Monday night game in the middle of that season.
So they do then right the ship. They win their next 2 against Miami and New Orleans. They lose to the Chiefs, so they're 6-5. And then they win out the rest of the regular season until the last game of the year, when I don't think they were playing for anything. They beat the Jets, the Bills, Tampa, the Jets again, and then they finish up losing to Miami. But they're 10-6. They win the division. It's good enough for the, I believe, just the number 4 seed in the AFC. I can check that, but they definitely didn't get a bye. So they were either the number 4 seed or the number 3 seed, and they actually would have had to have been the number 4 seed. But you know, just to give you the sense of some of the numbers on this team, from the Brady plays in all 16 games. He throws for 4,100 yards, 26 touchdowns. So, you know, a good year, not the kind of year he would put up a few years later. But, you know, the fact is, at this point, the offensive personnel they'd been getting away with for a few years because the defense was so good. You know, they finished with the 10th ranked offense and the 17th ranked defense. So, you know, certainly middling in any real way of looking at it. Their leading rusher is Corey Dillon with 700 yards. Their next leading rusher is Patrick Pass with 245 yards. Over the course of a 16-game season, they have 4 running backs who break the 100-yard barrier. Their leading receivers are Deion Branch has a really nice year. He finishes just 2 yards shy of 1,000. David Givens, Troy Brown, Ben Watson. It is still the guys from that first 2000s team. But the problem is they don't have the defense that they had the few years before that. We're just being functional on offense and throwing, you know, over the middle and you know, and that kind of thing is going to get it done.
Yeah, and not to leapfrog too much, but they do the same in 06. It's kind of the same thing. They're sort of still dependent on the defense and not, you know, not a lot of offensive weapons. And then, you know, 07, they go out and get Randy Moss. And then, you know, they start to embrace sort of some of these possession receiver type guys, but guys who are, you know, damn good receivers like Welker and Edelman later, and obviously Gronkowski. So, yeah, they definitely get more sort of high profile, high power pass receivers for Brady in the second decade of the dynasty. This middle period, 05, 06, it's more about the rushing game and also, you know, still the defense and Brady kind of doing what he can with what he has. And what they can do this year is lose to Denver in the playoffs.
So they host Jacksonville in the wild card game. It's the first time they've played in the wild card round in this era. And they beat the crap out of Jacksonville 28-3. It's the Saturday night wild card game. They, you know, it's never really a game. I guess it's 7-3 at halftime, but they blow them out in the second half. Where things get wild is, as we mentioned, all season, this was kind of seen as the Colts' year in the AFC. Mm-hmm. And the Colts did coast to the 1 seed. The other real big stories in the AFC that year were that Cincinnati, for the first time in a long, long time, had made the playoffs. And the next day, Cincinnati loses to Pittsburgh in Cincinnati. And that was the game where Kimo von Olhoffen basically exploded Carson Palmer's leg.
Okay. Yeah.
So the Steelers win that game. So the second round is going to be the Steelers against the Colts. and the Broncos are going to play the Patriots. And the Saturday night is Patriots Broncos in Denver. Jake Plummer is the quarterback. The Patriots turn it over 5 times. The Broncos get 24 points out of that. They actually, there was a couple of crazy swings in this game. The Patriots stop the Broncos on their 3-yard line. Plummer throws a pick 6. Brady throws a 51-yard pass. Okay, so with New England leading 3-0 with less than 2 minutes to go in the first half, Broncos linebacker Ian Gold recovered a fumble from Kevin Faulk on the Patriots' 40-yard line. After that, a pass interference penalty on Samuel moved the ball to the 1-yard line, and then Mike Anderson scored a 1-yard touchdown on the next play. So it was 10-3. It was 10-6 with less than a minute to go in the third quarter. New England's got the ball at the Denver 5-yard line. So they're, you know, about to at least make it a 1-point game, probably take the lead. Brady throws an interception that's returned by Champ Bailey 101 yards the other way, which is funny because it's not a touchdown. Benjamin Watson knocks the ball out of New England.
Yeah.
At the New England 1-yard line, they review whether it would have been a touchback. The original call stands. Broncos punch it in 17-6, and it's pretty much going away from there. It was 24-6, and then Brady threw a long touchdown to Deion Branch. But ultimately, the Broncos, the Jake Plummer Broncos, beat the Patriots, and it's the first playoff loss for Tom Brady, because the 3 years that he'd been in the playoffs before that, they'd won the Super Bowl. The Broncos would go on to then lose to the Steelers the next week, who were on their way to the Super Bowl. And this Patriots team kind of gets, you know, I mean, they really, not even kind of, it gets sort of cast aside. The next year they lose an AFC championship game to the Colts, and there, you know, there was a lot of drama in that playoffs. Then when the Chargers the week before, I don't think too many Patriots fans think a whole lot about this 05 team. Yeah. Even in the context of teams from this era that didn't win.
Agreed. Yeah, because that was a classic game. I think I was just looking at it. It was 38-34, Brady Manning in the AFC title game in 2006, you know, and then obviously 07 is the undefeated team that loses to the Giants. So yeah, you don't hear a ton about this team. So do you want to maybe kind of to close it out, maybe just you said rank them, and I had ranked them, but what criteria did you use in your rankings?
So, and real quick, I just wanted to do this before we get into that. I wrote down when the next title was for each of these teams.
Okay.
68 Packers, and my math might be off by a year or so, but 68 Packers, the Packers won again in 96, which was 28 years. The Dolphins have never won again, so I wrote 49 and counting. The 76 Steelers, it was 2 more years. The 80 Steelers, it was 25 more years to 2005. The 90 49ers, just 4 more years, 1994. The 94 Cowboys, just 1 more year to 95. 99 Broncos, 2015, so 16 years. And the 05 Patriots to 14, so 9 years. So
yeah,
a little bit of a range from 1 year to at least 50.
Yeah, Dallas is the only team. And in fact, I think that Dallas team is the only team. No, the Patriots did it too. Patriots won 3 out of 4 and Dallas won 3 out of 4. But Dallas did it sort of different, the way we're talking about, win 2, lose 1, and then go back and win the following year.
So to get to the criteria, I tried to be purely on who I think was the closest to three-peating. Not necessarily who was the best team, but who was the closest to three-peating, which I understand is subjective, but that's where I did it.
And of course, we should point out, if you haven't been listening very closely, none of these teams made the Super Bowl. So
yes.
All right, so I mean, I think the least is definitely the 99 Broncos. They were never in it.
Yeah, 8 is the Broncos, 6-10, never in it, 0-4. They're clearly 8. Number 7, I had the 68 Packers, who went to, you know, were 6-7-1, were eliminated with a game left, with at least a full game left. Of the three teams that didn't make the playoffs are obviously going to be 8-7-6. You could argue the other way with the 80 Steelers, but I mean, the 80 Steelers finished above 500. The 68 Packers didn't, but you know, I could see it either way.
Yeah. You'd have to get into the math with the divisions and figure out who was eliminated sooner. I mean, I know more about the 68 Packers and I know that they were in it at least until about like the second to last game of the season. But yeah, I mean, I'm willing to sort of defer to your ranking there, because it's, you know, it's the same basic type of thing.
And when I say closest, I'm also factoring in the other teams in the league at that point.
Yeah.
So I guess I look at the 80 Steelers and I say a wild card did win the Super Bowl that year with the Raiders.
Yeah, you'd have to figure that 68 Colts team was, or you know, even
yeah, they'd been 15-1. Their only loss had been to the Cleveland Browns. They'd just beaten the Browns in Cleveland. So that's where I landed with that. Of the non-playoff teams, 899 Broncos by a lot, 768 Packers, 680 Steelers.
All right, and then Sinan, we got what? Three teams that made the playoffs but didn't make the conference championship game, two. Right?
Just two.
Oh, so okay, because the 70. Okay, who am I missing here? 05 Patriots. Who are the three? 05 Patriots, 76 Steelers, and 74 Dolphins. Which one of those?
There's only two that went to the divisional round.
Oh, okay.
Three went to the conference championship.
Who was the third that went to the conference championship? Why am I blanking?
The 76 Steelers.
Oh, they did. Okay, you're right. You're right. I'm sorry. You're right.
So there's two teams that got to this, and you don't have to go in this way, but it makes the most sense to me. Like, you could put a team that went to the conference championship game here, but that doesn't. So it's between the 05 Patriots and the 74 Dolphins. I went for a second. I was trying to talk myself into, well, the Patriots were still the Tom Brady Patriots. And if they won that game, they would have been at home in the AFC championship game because they would have played the Steelers, because the Steelers would have beaten the Colts the next day anyway. I'm not getting into crazy domino theories about, you know, well, they would have been up watching that game. And they, like, I'm assuming every other game stays the same way. I thought about that, but I just, as you look at that 05 Patriot team, there's really not much to be impressed about. They were very much a 10-6 team. They weren't a 14-2 team that had some tough breaks, or Brady was hurt and they were getting hot at the right time. They also got their butts kicked by the Broncos in that game. That wasn't a close game. Whereas the 74 Dolphins had a lead with less than 2 minutes left on the road against that Raiders team that ultimately, yeah, they would have had to then beat the 74 Steelers. So, but I just ultimately, I thought five goes to the Patriots, four goes to the 74 Dolphins.
Yeah, I agree. Just want to see. I mean, yeah, I guess maybe I was briefly tempted to make an argument that 74 Dolphin team could even compare with some of those other teams. But Pittsburgh in 74 was probably a much better team. So, yeah, I'm comfortable with that. Yeah, I'm comfortable with that.
So that leaves us with the three conference championship teams. They all lost their conference championship game, and they all lost to the eventual Super Bowl champions, I guess, now that I think about it.
Let me add something else here, too. At least two of them, the 76 Steelers and the 90-49ers, were going to play teams in the conference, or in the Super Bowl, rather, that became notorious for not winning Super Bowls.
And that becomes a factor in a little bit, in my opinion.
Although, frankly, the 94 Cowboys, let's put it this way. I think that all three teams would have won the Super Bowl easily.
I don't know about easily, but I think they would. So let me, I have the 76 Steelers as three. And the reason I have the 76 Steelers at three, and I know a lot of people, Steeler fans, say this is the best Steeler team. This is the Steeler team that, you know, that they had that defensive run, all of that. I understand that. And I know that in the AFC championship game, they didn't have either of their running backs. The fact is they got their butts kicked in the AFC championship game by the Raiders. And Franco Harris and Rocky Blyer not playing on offense had very little to do with them allowing 24 points. This phenomenal defense got their lunch handed to them by the Raiders, who they also lost to in the regular season. The Raiders went 13-1 that year.
Yeah.
So to casually hand wave that Raiders team and to say, well, if Blyer and Harris had been healthy, if they had lost that game by three, different story. Now, I think that Steeler team, if somehow they got by the Raiders and played the Super Bowl, even without Blyer and Harris, I think at that point, the Vikings were incapable of winning the Super Bowl. I just don't think they would have at that point beaten any NFC team in the Super Bowl, or beaten, well, definitely not an NFC team. I don't know if they would have beaten Kansas City in the 76 Super Bowl, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. Cause that was their fourth one, but, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And last time they've been to one, but I can't so casually dismiss a 13-1 Raiders team.
Yeah.
That beat them by 17 points when the big argument people make is they were without both of their running backs. And it's like, well, if you really want to be, you could say, well, they would have controlled more of the clock. The Raiders wouldn't have been on the field as much. I got to put them third just by virtue of the way they lost that game and the caliber of that Raiders team.
Mm-hmm. I can agree with that. So we're between the 99ers and the 94 Cowboys for the last two.
So I'll just reveal what I went with the 90-49ers.
Yeah, me too.
The only way you could talk yourself, and it's a significant one to think about, is you could say the 90-49ers would have had to play the K-Gun Bills, who almost beat the Giants, who had this extremely high-powered offense that would have probably been, you know, a very exciting Super Bowl against the Montana 49ers, although we'll circle back to that in a minute. You could say this would have been a very, very good Super Bowl that they would not have been guaranteed to win. The 90 Bills were considered the best AFC playoff team in a very long time. AFC Super Bowl team.
Yeah.
Whereas if the 94 Cowboys, who admittedly weren't very close to beating the 49ers, had won, they would have hammered the Chargers just like the 49ers did.
Yeah.
That's the argument. And
I think you may have just talked me into it, frankly.
I'm spending a little too much time outlining my opponent's argument. The 49ers should have beaten the Giants. There was several things that happened in that game that led to the Giants winning. I don't think you can watch that game and come away with the thought that the Giants did. If one other play had not gone the Giants' way, the 49ers win.
Yeah.
The Giants had to fake a punt in that game. They had to knock Joe Montana out of the game. They had to get a fumble. Matt Barr had to hit 5 field goals in January on a muddy Candlestick Park field. San Francisco very easily could have won that game, should have won that game, etc. The only argument is that the Super Bowl would have been a harder game. But A, the 49ers were 4-0 in Super Bowls at that point. B, I think people kind of gloss over how good the 49ers defense was in 1990.
Yeah.
And they go like, oh, that would have been a 41-38 shootout. Well, no, because the 49ers defense, while maybe wouldn't have had the perfect game plan Bill Belichick had, would certainly have been able to put a real hurting on the Bills offense in the same way the Giants defense did, while also not having to rely on 10.5-minute drives. You don't think that Montana could have hit Jerry Rice or John Taylor a couple of times better than Hostetler could have hit Stephen Baker?
Well, now, and also, let's not forget that, you know, nobody is Belichick, but George Seifert had been an assistant coach on a defensive coach on 3 Super Bowl champion 49er teams, and then the head coach of a fourth. So it's not like the guy, you know, they had a pretty good defensive mind coming up with their game plan too.
And weren't there a couple other guys on that coaching staff too? Like, was
the only other
Ray Rhodes was the defensive backs coach. Mike Holmgren was the offensive coordinator. John Gruden was an assistant there.
Gruden was an offense. Yeah. So the only guy really, I mean, I don't know who the defensive Bill McPherson, who I have to admit, I have no idea who that is. So yeah, they didn't necessarily have a powerhouse defensive coaching staff, but they did have a really good defensive coach in George Seifert.
So the only way, I mean, I guess if you really wanted to say, well, let's say, I mean, if you play it out, we're like, well, Montana's still hurt. Barr misses that last second field goal and Montana's still hurt. And it's Steve Young and the 49ers offense against the Bills, because Montana wouldn't have been able to play the next week. That hit by Leonard Marshall wasn't why he was out for 2 years, but he wouldn't have been able to play the next week in the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Is that sort of accepted as fact? Because I know that I personally have wondered through the years, like, you know, you tend to think he was definitely out because he didn't play two seasons. But like you said, it was more the recovery. But OK, I will take your word for the fact that Joe Montana was not going to be able to even try to play a week later. And everybody, it's easy to say, well, Steve Young is a Hall of Famer. But, you know, talking about a guy who barely played the last 2 years, you don't know that Young would have done much of anything. So.
And I watched the first Monday night game of the next season, and he's not great in that.
The Giants beat him.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then on the other side with the Cowboys, you say, yes, they would have beaten the Chargers easily. They really were not competitive in that game against the 49ers, really at any point, certainly not. And they lost to them earlier in the regular season. If they had lost that game by 3, I would say no question they were closer to winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But they were clearly not better than the 49ers that year, whereas the 49ers were clearly better than the Giants. And that 49ers team against that Bills team, straight up, let's say Montana's playing, you're picking the 49ers. You're not shocked that the Bills win, but you're picking the 49ers.
Yeah, I mean, other than that, whereas with the 49ers in 94, no matter who play, I mean, there's probably 3 or 4 NFC teams. You know, Green Bay probably beats the Chargers in 94. The Lions with Barry Sanders beat them in 94. Like, there's probably 4 or 5 teams, NFC teams in 1994 that beat the San Diego Chargers in the Super Bowl. That's other than maybe like the 85 Patriots. That's the other one that comes to mind. That is one of the first two
in terms of being overmatched, but that barely counts. I mean, they were in a different league.
Yeah. But also, I mean, if you think about it, like that you're talking about the first two Super Bowls.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the Chiefs ended up winning a title 2 years later, 3 years later. And, you know, the Raiders, while it was a little bit of a different team, became a powerhouse of the 70s. 85 Pats, 94 Chargers. Those are two teams that only played in that one Super Bowl, were completely wiped out of it. And just were completely dominated from beginning to end. I guess you could also say the 98 Falcons, but even they kind of don't necessarily reach the same level as those other two.
You know who else you could put in there?
The 2000 Giants.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I look at them differently because they're the Giants. Maybe I look at them differently because they're the Giants. That's fair. But also, I mean, they also, and again, I'm not looking to really, when we're getting a little bit far afield, the Giants had sort of had a really, really strong playoff run, beating the Vikings 41-0. Whereas I feel like those other two teams really kind of squeaked in, but that's a story for a different day. So,
So yeah, that's where I land. I totally would understand the argument that somebody could make about the Cowboys just because of the Super Bowl, the difference in difficulty in the Super Bowl. But just, I thought about it for like a day, not consecutively. I thought about other stuff in the middle, but ultimately, I wrote down 2 or 1 for both of them, and then I just took my notebook and circled 1 for the Niners and 2 for the Cowboys.
we will have to maybe edit this episode and
well, I said the S word, so we'll definitely have to edit that out.
Well, yes, we'll definitely edit that out. Well, we'll have to maybe do an edit and sort of 6 months from now or 4 months from now, whatever it is, 5 months, tack it on where we talk about. Now, I mean, I guess obviously if the Chiefs win it all again this year, then that's
they would be number one.
Then that would be irrelevant. But if they don't make it, we'll
if
have
they
to
lose in the Super Bowl to the Miracle Giants led by Daniel Jones.
Oh, my God. yeah. And I mean, I guess I don't know. I haven't looked too closely at the coming NFL season, and we don't do prognostications here of current sports. But you got to feel like they got a better chance going in than close to half of the teams, probably, you know, our bottom four, the Patriots, the Steelers of 80, the Packers and the 99 Broncos, they definitely have a better chance than those four teams going in. So we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We'll tag on to this in a couple, either in December or January or February, depending on how close the Chiefs get.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see no matter what, how the playoffs actually play out, even if they're not till the end. So it'll be, we'll wait till after the Super Bowl. So we enjoyed it. Like I said, this will probably drop right as the NFL season is getting started. So hopefully it'll provide a little bit of historical context to something that a team is trying to do in the 2024 NFL season. And as you enjoy that 2024 NFL season, we'll also be dropping podcasts every couple of weeks on a number of sports history topics. So we will be part of your sports landscape in the fall for the fifth year in a row. But until then, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
Hi, everybody. We are back about 6 months later, 6 months or so from when we first recorded this episode. And we told you that once the NFL season wrapped up, we would sort of hop back on here for a few minutes and talk about the 2024 Kansas City Chiefs and how they did in their effort to three-peat. And I don't know, Andrew, I think we might have somebody new at the top of the list for who came the closest.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when we did this episode last, we went through, what was it, 8 teams that repeated, 7 or 8?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I could probably go through my notes, but so, you know, the furthest anybody had gotten before this was a couple of teams had gotten to the conference championship game. And, you know, the debate at the time was the two teams we really talked about, 94 Cowboys, who won 2 in a row, lost to the 49ers, lost fairly badly, but probably would have won the Super Bowl. And then there was the 1990 49ers, who lost a really close game to the Giants, would have faced a tougher challenge in the Super Bowl than the 94 Cowboys would have. But, you know, it was, ultimately we decided they were probably the best. Now we have this kind of different category of a team that won their conference championship, but then the Super Bowl was canceled. and it's certainly not a thing we need to discuss. So I quantify that. I don't know.
Andrew's Eagles hatred is coming through a little bit there. So, you know, it's funny. And obviously, you know, we don't need to analyze the Kansas City Chiefs 2024 season. That was done by many people. But it was one of those things where it seemed like all you heard about all year was what a tough year they were having. And, you know, it was kind of the usual suspects, Buffalo, Baltimore, you know, would one of those teams kind of come to the fore? But the Chiefs were 9-0. They kept winning really close games, you know, 27-20, 26-25, 22-17, 17-10, 27-20, 30-24, 16-14. You know, one of those was in overtime. Then they lost to Buffalo, and then they went right back to 30-27, 19-17, 19-17, 27-19. You know, they had two losses on the season. One was a close loss to Buffalo in a marquee matchup in mid-November. And then the other was their last game of the year in early January against the Broncos, when Mahomes and Kelce and a bunch of other guys sat on the sidelines because they didn't have anything else to play for. And I remember all year, I just kept saying, I was like, guys, they keep winning and they keep finding a way to beat good teams. So there's really no reason to believe that that's not going to continue. And up until the Super Bowl, it really did. You know, they edged out the Texans, you know, 9-point win. They edged out Buffalo by a field goal. We won't talk about, you know, obviously once they got to the Super Bowl, they were completely blown out. What was it, 40-8 at some point, I think was the score. It ended up being 40-22, but I think it was 40-8 at one point. Probably the least competitive Super Bowl since, what would it have been? I think exactly 10 years earlier, maybe Broncos, 11 years. Yeah. Broncos and the Seahawks that year, Manning's first Super Bowl with the Broncos, Peyton Manning. But up until the Super Bowl, and who knows what happened there, I think there's a lot of theories, but they were right there in it as probably the best team in the league for most of the season.
Yeah, and I think your point is your first point there. You know, they weren't really the team that got talked about most of the year, I think, because they were winning, but they weren't doing it in super dominant game against Baltimore that they won. They were playing, you know, not a lot of marquee matchups. I mean, Cincinnati didn't end up being very good, although at the time in week two, you know, they were probably supposed to be better. And they were playing, you know, Atlanta, New Orleans, and the Chargers, who I know ultimately ended up being a playoff team. But even the Super Bowl rematch against San Francisco, by then San Francisco had really struggled out of the gates, and the Raiders and the Broncos and, you know, all that. And then they play Buffalo, and Buffalo beat them pretty solidly. It ended up being 30-21, but I think it might, like, Buffalo was ahead the whole game. They were never, you know, it really felt like Buffalo was in control of the game. And then, like you said, after that, they're back to close wins. So it was like, you knew they were going to be good. You knew they were, you know, once they lost that one game and there was like, okay, they're not going to go undefeated, obviously. You knew, okay, we're going to return our focus to this team at some point. But I would remark sometimes on my weekly show about current sports saying, you know, it's weird how little a team that's going for a three-peat and has one loss is, you know, how little attention that's getting. But there were so many other stories. You had the Eagles, you had Detroit, Buffalo, you know, even Harbaugh in L.A. getting that team into the play. There was just a lot going on in the NFL season. But like you said, they really, you know, starting right around Christmas when they played that like round robin in those 4 days, the Saturday before Christmas on the 21st when they beat Houston, and then they beat up on Pittsburgh on Christmas and they wrapped everything up. They were 15-1. So the Denver game really doesn't count. That was not only was that they didn't play anybody. I mean, they did not care. That was as close to a forfeit as you're going to see. So really they went 15-1, you know, and then they go into the playoffs and they get Houston again. And it's close, but they beat them solidly. So that after they win that game, you're thinking, actually, I mean, I should say in this game, it was 13-12 in the third quarter. And then, it was all Kansas City from then on, and Kansas City ended up winning 24-13. So they go to the AFC Championship game against the Bills, the only team that had really beaten them all year, you know, when they were trying to win. And, you know, this one was back and forth. And in hindsight, you kind of go, all right, you know, Kansas City, Buffalo tied it 29-29, and then Butker hit a field goal with 3.5 minutes. Again, we don't want to go through the second most recent football game played on our history podcast, but it was there was a lot of balls in that game that probably could have gone the other way. You know, that again, I never buy into any grand conspiracy theories, but certainly a few calls could have gone either way that went to Kansas City. But they go into the Super Bowl and they're playing the Eagles, who were, you know, a really good team, had a, you know, a really good year and really cruised. They got a little bit of a tough time with the Rams in the second round, but other than that, it really cruised through the NFC playoffs. And, you know, I mean, it was 36-0 at one point in this game. It was 40-6 at one point in this game. It is weird to see a team as good as the Chiefs dismantled like this. Now, I think if they played this game 10 times, I think the result we saw probably only happens once, but I think it's fair to say the Eagles probably would have won seven of them. You know what I mean? If you look, if not eight or nine, so again, while I think the actual result was an outlier in terms of just how bad it was, you can't really watch that game and say, oh, on any other given day, the Chiefs would have won.
Yeah, you definitely would think so in retrospect. A couple other points I just want to make real quick. The one thing that I think is going to be remembered, you know, or going to be talked about when this team gets looked back on, other than some of the obvious things, is that with some of the stuff with the calls, they really kind of made themselves dislikable and a team that everybody was rooting against, you know, other than Eagles haters and, you know, fans of the team. And, you know, I know maybe some people didn't like seeing Taylor Swift all the time or whatever, but for me, it was kind of like, there was one play I think it was the second playoff game, the conference. I think it was in the conference championship game where they had already gotten a couple of not on offense. They had gotten a couple of personal fouls against the Ravens that maybe they shouldn't have gotten. And then Mahomes went to the sideline in a quarterback run, and then purposefully stood in front of the sideline, hoping that he would be able to basically trick the refs into getting a late hit call and that type of thing. Look, I don't begrudge the guy trying to do whatever he can to win, but it really made me kind of dislike the team and root pretty hard against them just because I was just sick of it. So I was just sick of sort of the on the field antics. So that, I don't know if you agree with that, but they did make themselves hard to root for with the way the refs seem to be giving them a lot of calls.
I mean, I would agree that they got calls, but I had a tough time because the last two teams they played are not teams I'm particularly fond of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all along, and this has now not worked for me twice. I was kind of looking.
Let me just break in. I said the Ravens. I meant the Bills. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was kind of looking at them as my best hope to beat the Eagles. So I was rooting for them the whole way through. I mean, I get it. Any team that wins a bunch, people are going to stop rooting for. But I think to get back to sort of our task at hand, you'd have to consider this number one because they got around further. I mean, they got to the Super Bowl, so we really can't. Now, if any other team got to the Super Bowl, they would not be in front of that team.
Exactly.
Because they did not get the closest. But you're then extrapolating – if you talk about like the 90 49ers, you're then extrapolating, well, if they had gotten past the Giants, they would have played a whole other game and won instead of a Chiefs team that was in that game.
The only other one I would say could potentially be close would be the 94 Cowboys, because now they weren't as close against the Niners in the conference championship as the Niners were against the Giants 4 years earlier. Mm-hmm. But either the Niners, the Cowboys, and maybe even a couple other NFC teams would have smacked the Chargers in that Super Bowl. So that's the only one that comes immediately to mind. So, but yeah, they're a solid, you know, they are at the top of the list and will be for a while because another team's going to have to win at least two in a row before we even have this conversation again.
If we're talking about it going in like a year from now, we won't be, because I won't be. There's only one thing that could mean, and I'll have no part in it.
All right. Well, we hope you guys enjoyed the episode and then this little addendum here. And like we promised, we would jump on and do it. So we already closed it the right way, so we're not going to do it again. But thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Take care.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear. starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.